Palestinians warn Israel's plan to hold the so-called flag march in Al-Quds can lead to an explosion in the situation across occupied territories. Foreign ministers of Armenia and Azerbaijan are to meet in Moscow on Friday to discuss the two countries' dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. A deal between Moscow and Kiev, which allows Ukraine to export its grain through the Black Sea, is extended for two more months. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. And our spokesman for the Palestinian presidency warns Israel's insistence on holding the so-called flag march will raise tensions in occupied territories. Nabil Abu Rudaina said provocative march, which is planned for this Thursday, will ignite the region and its consequences will be dire. The spokesman added Israel will be fully responsible for any escalation resulting from the march. Abu Rudaina noted the occupied city of Al-Quds will remain the eternal capital of the state of Palestine. The Palestinian Hamas resistance movement also announced the march as a failed attempt by Israel to implement its plans of racist Judaization. Flag march marks Israel's occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds in 1967. The annual march is organized by far-right Israeli settlers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinian officials say latest Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip displaced more than 450 families, consisting of over 2,500 people. Coastal Territories Ministry of Social Development said the displaced Gazans include more than 1,000 children and nearly 700 women. It added more than 64% of Gaza's population suffers from food insecurity, while the poverty rate stands at 60% as a result of Israel's brutal siege. The ministry also condemned the international silence towards Israel's crimes against children of Gaza, who are direct targets of the regime's aggression. Israel attacked Gaza for 5 days starting May 9th. Onslaught claimed more than 30 lives, many of them women and children. A growing number of Israelis are now applying for passports after recent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip and retaliatory strikes by Palestinian resistance factions. In our news review segment of our bulletin earlier, we discussed what's been labeled a passport crisis and whether that bodes well for the future of the regime.
On this segment of the program, Israelis are racing to obtain passports as the regime's recent bloodshed in the Gaza Strip and Palestinians' retaliatory strikes have caused havoc among them. Israel's interior minister has called the situation a passport crisis, with reporting a major logjam of people applying for or renewing passports. It has prompted the regime to launch Operation Passport Marathon and create appointment for free passport counters, which will be operating for a month. On the first day of the operation alone, over 6,000 passports were issued. That's according to official figures. Israeli media claimed the surge in passport demands is due to the backlog caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But a survey conducted last year showed Israelis are becoming more and more worried about their future. That's due to the growing might of Palestinian resistance forces, a cost of living crisis, and the power struggle inside Israel. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Joining us from Edinburgh, also from Gaza City, we have Palestinian political activist Monty Abu Musabbeh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Napier in Edinburgh. Give us your perspective on this so-called passport crisis that Israelis are facing now.
Well, I think against a background of terrible news from Palestine, increasing cost for the Palestinians, increasing brutality and horror at the moment, a spike from the Israeli authorities, it's great to welcome some good news. And when we hear that Israelis are reaching for a second passport, we know that the morale of the Zionist bloc in Palestine has been damaged. And I've made a study of this over the years. It's quite fascinating. We hear, of course, that some of the settlers are leaving the occupied West Bank, which is under direct military occupation. It's important to know there are two types of settler, really. There are fanatics who believe they have a real estate deal with the deity who has given them the land. They really believe that Europeans can take anything they want in Palestine. But there are other settlers who were sent there or attracted there by very substantial economic benefits, reduced rent, all sorts of economic benefits. And some of them will be thinking now it's not worth it when Palestinian resistance is rising. So I, just to sum up, I think that, that this is a crisis of morale, and it shows that resistance can actually weaken the Israeli society, and I think it's entirely good news.
Moti Abu Mossabeh, let's bring him in on the discussion. Mr. Mossabeh, has the resistance managed to rattle the morale of the Israelis?
Yep. First of all, thanks for having me. I would like to assert on what your guest has just mentioned, that this is one of the ramifications and one of the consequences brought to the Israeli occupation by the latest Palestinian response regarding the Palestinian resistance. And no one can deny that this puts more pressure on the current hardline Israeli government. And it's another crisis, another internal crisis added to the ongoing and escalating internal crisis, simply because this current government is totally preoccupied and busy just by entrenching the occupation and trying to cement the grip on the Palestinian people, and trying just to deprive and to make sure that they are depriving the Palestinian people of having any kind of sovereign state. So this reveals clearly that the current Israeli government is not able just to handle the internal emerging issues, and it adds more evidence how fragile and weak this current government is. This is on one hand. On the other hand, it reveals clearly that the Palestinian resistance today is standing in opposition that enables it to practice more pressure and to exert more pressure on the Israeli community. In this context, I would remind you that in 2021, after the battle of Saif al-Quds confrontation between the Palestinian resistance factions and the Israeli occupation, then it was reported that, according to the polls among the Israelis, then after that confrontation, many Israelis reported that the Israeli community literally is facing a societal rift over the ongoing and the repetitive confrontations with the Palestinian resistance. So this reveals that the response of the Palestinian resistance factions nowadays is unlike any kind of any response in the precedented years. Today, the Palestinian resistance factions are able to deter the Israeli occupation. They can actually weaken the internal situation inside the Israeli occupation, and it actually makes it very clear that the Palestinian resistance factions today can, according to the military resistance and according to the development and the enhanced abilities of the Palestinian resistance, especially in Gaza Strip, they are able to deter the Israeli occupation and to impose new realities on the Israeli occupation. So this indicates clearly that today the Palestinian people are able to confront the Israeli occupation. And on the other hand, it reveals also that this kind of connection between the Israeli settlers and this land is totally vanished, and it reveals how weak this kind of connection to this land, and it reveals clearly that the real owners of this land is the Palestinian people, because at the same time that thousands of the Israeli settlers are scrambling to take their passports, to have their passports in order to leave this land, at the same time many Palestinian or the Palestinian people, despite the ongoing and the cruel and the relentless Israeli aggression and the Israeli airstrikes that leveled their houses to the ground, we have witnessed that many Palestinians shown high steadfastness in this regard, and they were sending messages of defiance and messages of challenge to the Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli brutality.
Sure.
So yes, putting these two senses and comparing these senses together actually indicates clearly that the Palestinian people today are standing defiantly on their land. At the same time, the Israelis and the Israeli settlers are scrambling to leave this land.
All right, that's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Thanks to Mr. McNapier joining us from Edinburgh, and thanks to Muti Abu Musape from Gaza City.
And welcome back, everyone. And the foreign ministers of Armenia and Azerbaijan are to meet in Moscow to discuss a decades-long dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson said the meeting, which will also be attended by the Russian Foreign Minister, will take place on May 19th. Maria Zakharova added the trilateral talks are expected to focus on a draft peace treaty. This after early Wednesday, Armenia said that one of its soldiers was killed after Azeri forces opened fire at the two countries' common border. Azerbaijan dismissed the accusation as a lie. On Sunday, Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan and Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev met in Brussels for a new round of talks. Another meeting between Pashinyan and Aliyev is slated for June 1st in Moldova and expected to involve the French President Emmanuel Macron and the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. A deal between Moscow and Kiev that allows Ukraine to export its grain through the Black Sea has been extended for two more months. The extension was announced by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He hailed Ukraine, Russia, and the UN for their cooperation. Moscow also confirmed the renewal. Earlier, Kremlin had threatened, though, not to agree to the extension due to Western sanctions against Russia, arguing that the restrictive measures have hindered Moscow's own farm exports. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has lauded the extension, saying that it is essential for overcoming global food insecurity.
These agreements matter for global food security. Ukrainian and Russian products feed the world. Under the Black Sea Initiative, more than 10 million tons of food have been exported. Vital food supplies are reaching some of the world's most vulnerable people and places, including 30,000 tons of wheat that just left Ukraine aboard a WFP chartered ship to feed hungry people in Sudan. Some positive and significant
developments. The confirmation by the Guterres, however, said outstanding issues remain, expressing hope a comprehensive agreement can be reached. The Ukraine grain deal was initially brokered by Turkey and the UN in July last year to help tackle a global food crisis that has been exacerbated in the face of the Ukraine war. Now the Ukrainian military says it's made new advances near the eastern city of Bakhmut in heavy fighting with Russian forces. Ukraine's military spokesperson said the country's forces have successfully conducted a defensive operation, penetrating up to 500 meters in some parts. The official, however, noted Russian forces are seeking to take over the city at will, striking Ukrainians with all systems and calibers. He added Russia is moving new units to Bakhmut in an attempt to achieve some kind of intermediate success. Bakhmut has been the focal point of fighting between Russia and Ukraine for about 10 months now. The city is seen by Moscow as a stepping stone towards capturing the rest of the eastern industrial region of Donbas, which borders Russia. The European Union's foreign policy chief has asked for 3.5 billion euros to be added to a fund that is used to finance military aid for Ukraine. EU sources said that Joseph Borrell has asked EU members to raise a financial ceiling for this fund, known as the European Peace Facility. The fund has already allocated some 4.6 billion euros in military aid to Ukraine. Borrell's proposal has to be first approved by EU governments. U.S. and its Western allies have been pumping massive amounts of money and military hardware into Ukraine since the war with Russia began last year. Moscow's time and again warned that the West's military aid will only prolong the war. And now torrential rains followed by floods and landslides have battered northern Italy, killing nine people and forcing thousands to leave their homes. Authorities said flooding hit nearly 40 towns and communities in Emilia-Romagna region, causing around 120 landslides. Officials say some areas receive half their average annual rainfall in just 36 hours, causing rivers to burst their banks. Floodwaters then cascaded through towns, submerging thousands of acres of farmland. This is the second time this month the region has been battered by bad weather. Storms killed at least two people at the beginning of May. Experts say the months-long drought has dried out the land, reducing its capacity to absorb water and worsening the impact of the floods. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Netanyahu's latest assault on Gaza is a well-worn strategy among Zionist politicians to manufacture unity during times of internal strife. This is why the Zionist regime's violent Gaza strategy to divide Palestinian resistance will fail. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye noted, in the early morning hours of Tuesday, May 9th, the Zionist regime forces launched a brutal military attack on the Gaza Strip, killing 15 people, including three leaders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, PIJ, four children and four women. Israeli regime forces reported that a total of 40 warplanes participated in the targeted assassination campaign that lasted about 2 hours. Israeli outlets also indicated that the military operation may continue for a few days, with Prime Minister Netanyahu promising a broader campaign and severe blows against Gaza. It is clear that the Zionist regime's latest attack, which Haaretz reports was meticulously planned in advance, targets everyone in Gaza. The kill list, including the distinct possibility of civilians being killed alongside them, was vetted and approved by legal advisors. The atmosphere in those days was like this. Feeling of despair and anger persisted in Gaza as the population continued to live under the constant threats of bombs. According to Palestinian health officials, the death toll in Gaza had reached 21, with 64 more injured due to the Zionist regime's aggression in those hours. The attacks on Gaza came despite an Egypt-brokered ceasefire agreement last August between the Zionist regime and the Islamic Jihad, with the support from UN Special Coordinator for the West Asia Region Process, Tor Wennesland. There were even popular demands for response and revenge, while others feared another horrific war on the besieged strip, where civilians remain in the eye of the storm. The Zionist regime's assault on Gaza indicated that the Zionist regime does not respect agreements and flouts international law. It appeared that Israeli leaders were moving forward with the right-wing and racist agenda, which seeks to resolve the conflict by force. by reviving the Zionist regime's brutal targeted assassinations policy, Netanyahu seeks to restore the image of deterrence that was cracked due to the resurgence of popular resistance movements in Gaza and the West Bank. Netanyahu aimed to preserve the ruling right-wing coalition, especially after far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir continued to threaten his party's boycott of weekly Israeli cabinet meetings until he is given significant influence over national security policy. Knowing this could lead to the government's fracture, including a failure to approve the annual budget and therefore push early elections that could lead to his toppling. Netanyahu, whose popularity has declined in the occupied territories significantly in favor of Benny Gantz and his National Unity Party, has chosen to shift the focus to Gaza. Netanyahu's latest assault on Gaza is a well-known and well-worn strategy among Israeli politicians to manufacture unity during times of internal strife. After months of mass protest against the ruling coalition's plans to overthrow the judiciary, Netanyahu believes he can end the judicial crisis now in its 18th week, or at least halt the protest by rallying Zionist unity against an external threat. And this is while the Joint Operations Room for the Resistance Movements in Gaza announced that the groups are united and ready to respond to the Zionist regime's attacks. This indicated a failure to undermine Palestinian resistance, which the Zionist regime attempt to fracture by targeting only Islamic Jihad commanders. The Zionist regime forces threatened to carry out targeted assassinations against Hamas leaders if they were to participate in any military response to Israeli regime aggression. The occupation regime is anxious about Palestinian unity and has built its policy on mechanisms of fragmentation and division. It has managed to do so geographically by separating the Gaza Strip from the West Bank and dividing the latter into enclaves. It is now trying to separate the resistance forces from each other. The resistance groups understand that the conflict with the Zionist regime and its settler colonial project is historical and existential, and that all Palestinian political factions are within the Zionist regime's target circle. Therefore, experts believe that the policy of division and fragmentation has been failed so far and will fail. It should be noted that the escalation by the government of new fascists Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, and Minister of Finance Bezalel Smotrich is not limited to the Gaza Strip, but extends to the West Bank, Al-Quds, 1948 Palestinians, and the political prisoners. The occupation government is under the illusion that its policy will break the will and steadfastness of Palestinian people and their determination to resist and a struggle. If the fascist right-wing government poses a threat to Palestinian people, it is important to turn this threat into an opportunity by working towards achieving a unified struggle in the field. Examples include pursuing action against Israeli regime war criminals in international courts, promoting popular resistance and diplomacy, exposing the fascist and racist nature of the occupying Israeli regime, and revealing the deep connection between Zionism, fascism, and racism. Palestinians are now waiting to see what will happen in the coming days and hours. Though the situation seems to be moving, the failure of the fabricated regime of Israel. Anyway, Palestinians across the occupied territories continue to emphasize national unity on the basis of resistance and struggle, including the importance of practicing all forms of legitimate struggle to defend the freedom and dignity of Palestinian people. That the Zionist regime would engage in yet another brutal campaign against Gaza on the coming days only confirms the nature of the Zionist colonial project as an aggressive and racist system built on violence and ethnic cleansing.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here are some thought-provoking words from the Holy Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, whose martyrdom anniversary we commemorated yesterday on the 25th day of Shawwal. The true believers are those who fear God and strive hard so that the guidance they have been provided will not be taken away from them. If they remember God and His grace, they feel apprehensive and fearful. If God's verses are recited before them, this increases their faith and they have complete trust in their Lord.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what to do when our parents quarrel. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may His peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salaamu Alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z, IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for this session. We're going to start our program today with a question, and that is, my mother and father disagree with each other over everything, no matter how big or small, and we, the children, become upset whenever the quarrels begin. We are afraid and worried about the future of the family. The question is, what should we do? This question is a very common question, and some families probably suffer from this kind of problems, unfortunately. And it's very bad. This condition is very also suffering for the children who live in such families. So to answer this question, I would suggest the children of these families that when your parents are at peace, talk to them about the negative effects of quarrel, which may destroy everyone's future. But when they are quarrelling, you have to be tolerant and indifferent towards what is happening as long as there are no dangerous events. So when you become impatient, go to a different place, for example, to another room or the yard. And when they begin quarrelling, try to play a cast of Quranic recitation or decide to exchange jokes amongst each other to stop their quarrelling by laughter. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A2Z IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page, and we were talking about the children and how they can control the anger of their parents when they are crawling and how to actually survive in such a condition. And based on what we understand from Quran and Hadith, we actually gave some principles that, which were quite important, and it was when they are at peace, we can talk to them and warn them about the bad end of this such a story, such a leaving. And when they are quarreling, we should be tolerant and indifferent about what is happening and try to change the atmosphere by, for example, playing a cast of Quranic recitation or making joke between them to lessen actually their anger and their emotion. But it is necessary for you to know that this state, although it is dangerous for your future if it continues, and it can be solved if you undertake your responsibility as adult children in the house and as an alternative to the parents who are sunken in the fire of rage and selfishness. So don't worry, you will soon grow and live independently away from them. In order to not be like your parents, you should take lessons from their state. For as Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has said, a reasonable one is he who takes lessons from the experiments of others. So by looking at such a parent, we have to understand and we have to take this lesson that if we continue this way, we will get our future and our belongings future in danger. So actually we can study and we can learn from such families that living in this way will not have a good end. So we can control our emotion, we can control our feelings, our anger, by the principles that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has declared in Quran by Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam in our authentic ahadith, how to live a life in peace and ease, inshallah. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The French president and the head of the European Commission flew into Beijing. Their joint trip was the latest in a push from European leaders to engage with China and persuade President Xi to take further steps to halt the Ukraine-Russia conflict, which has brought about an energy crisis with all its concomitant sufferings for Europe. If the war rages on, there is no guarantee of a good year ahead for the Europeans, as they're already struggling to keep the energy crisis at bay. There was a belief that Russia was heavily dependent on Western technologies to keep its oil and gas flowing, dependent on Western markets for its revenues and on Western financial systems to facilitate its energy exports. It was hoped that if cut off from these, Moscow would face rapid economic collapse. No doubt the European oil and oil products embargo did result in higher costs for Russian operators, but they do not appear to have significantly damaged the Russian oil trade. Now, a year after the war, Russian oil production is also at pre-war levels. Despite the media hype, the European leaders know that the energy war they have been engaged in with Russia is still far from over. Currently, Europe faces a number of energy sector-related risks in 2023. These include a rapid recovery in Chinese economic demand, which would bring the country back into the global market for LNG and increase competition for global cargoes. With LNG global production likely to remain limited throughout the current year, LNG supplies will be reduced, and as a result, Western manufacturers might be facing tougher competition from Asia. The situation could be further compounded if another year of drought impacts hydroelectricity production. These are also concerns over technical problems at France's aging nuclear power stations. If nuclear facilities are forced to undergo unplanned maintenance for an extensive period of time, Europe would be obliged to switch on its gas-fired generation, lifting demand for the fuel. Moscow might also try to recreate the 1973 energy crisis by withdrawing its oil from the markets. So far, though, it's been pragmatic and preferred to work around the embargoes. Against such a backdrop, Europe is trying to diversify its energy portfolio, but gigawatts of solar and wind power cannot be added overnight. Planning, funding, and building wind and solar farms is a multi-year process and cannot help Europe out in the immediate future. Diversification also means increasing gas flows through pipelines from Norway to North Africa, but even more notably, a dramatic increase in liquefied gas imports from countries such as the US or Qatar. But again, it might increase the risks of new dependencies from countries that could pose a geoeconomic risk to Europe in the future. While transitioning away from Russian energy is the EU's top priority, that will not be easy. Despite the fall in energy imports from Russia since the war, Russian energy still accounted for more than 40% of Europe's stored gas for last winter. The short-term story is therefore one of elevated prices and heightened volatility as countries scramble to identify alternative sources of gas, a cocktail of inflation and recession. Right now, headline inflation is at 8.5%. Falling purchasing power means Europeans are eating less, not just heating less. Average food consumption fell by 4.6% last year in France, something not seen since records began in 1960, and will likely fuel protests but threaten to bring the country to a standstill. In Spain, Zara owner Inditex SA recently agreed to increase the pay of its store workers by an average of 20%. This will come at a huge cost as governments deal with rising prices while simultaneously subsidizing their population's energy bills. And if recession has so far been averted, it's because states undertook huge spending efforts worth close to $1 trillion to protect households and to facilitate a reversal of dependence on Russian gas. Repeating the feat in 2023 will be a struggle. Meanwhile, major oil-producing countries are cutting supplies of crude. Less oil flowing to refineries should mean higher gasoline prices for drivers and could boost the inflation hitting Europe. That may also help Russia weather Western sanctions. It seems that the energy crisis has just begun, and next winter is where the real challenge lies.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey shows that majority of Germans oppose NATO membership for Ukraine. According to the poll, more than half of the German population is also in favor of peace talks between Kiev and Moscow. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted more than half of Germans do not support the idea of Ukraine joining NATO. A YouGov poll commissioned by Germany's DPA news agency shows as many as 54% of the respondents oppose the prospect, the news agency reported recently. only 27% of those polled said they would agree to offer Kiev the prospect of membership in the U.S.-led military bloc. In April, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed that most Europeans would not understand if Kiev does not get a well-deserved invitation to join NATO. The Ukrainian leader is now expected to take part in a NATO summit in Lithuania in July, according to DPA. Most Germans want Kiev to start negotiations with Moscow instead, the YouGov poll shows. According to the survey, 55% of respondents called for negotiations between Russian and Ukraine parts on ending the conflict. Only 28% oppose this. And the poll comes as Berlin has just announced another massive weapons package for Ukraine. Worth more than 2.7 billion euros, the new arms delivery is expected to include four German-made ground-based IRIST air defense systems, something the German armed forces themselves do not yet possess, as well as 30 Leopard 1 battle tanks, 20 infantry fighting vehicles, 100 armored personnel carriers, 18 wheeled self-propelled artillery systems, and 200 reconnaissance drones. Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said recently, "With this valuable contribution of urgently needed military equipment, we are showing once again that Germany is serious about its support." He did not elaborate on when the arms are expected to be delivered to Ukraine. The deputy head of the Conservative Union CDU-CSU parliamentary faction, John Waterpool, has called on Berlin to allow Ukrainians to use the German-made weapons against targets inside Russia. He told Tagesspiegel daily, "Neither under international law nor politically is there any reason why Ukraine shouldn't be allowed to attack targets in Russia." Meanwhile, the German public has been wary of the massive military support provided to Kiev throughout the conflict. In February, almost two-thirds of Germans polled opposed providing Kiev with fighter jets, a survey showed. In December 2022, a YouGov poll indicated that 45% were against sending German Leopard 2 battle tanks to Ukraine. A number of German celebrities and public figures also sent two open letters addressed to Chancellor Olaf Scholz, in which they asked Berlin to stop sending arms to Ukraine and to do everything instead to reach a ceasefire as soon as possible and find a compromise that both sides can accept. Russia has repeatedly warned that pumping Ukraine with weapons will only prolong the suffering and create risks of further escalation of the hostilities up to a direct confrontation between Moscow and NATO. It also said it was ready for a peaceful solution to the conflict, as long as its goals are achieved and its interests are taken into account. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera English reported Germany will provide Ukraine with additional military aid worth almost $3 billion, including tanks, anti-aircraft systems and ammunition, the government announced ahead of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's arrival in Berlin. German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said recently that Berlin wanted to show with its latest military aid package worth 2.7 billion euros that Germany is serious in its support for Ukraine. He said Germany will provide all the help it can as long as it takes. Though initially slow to provide military aid to Kiev, Germany has since become one of the biggest suppliers of arms to Ukraine, crucially given the green light for the delivery of modern battle tanks in the form of its own Leopard 1 and 2 models, along with sophisticated anti-aircraft systems needed to fend off drone and missile attacks. The new military aid package, first reported by German weekly Der Spiegel includes 30 Leopard 1A5 tanks, 20 Marder armored personnel carriers, more than 100 combat vehicles, 18 self-propelled howitzers, 200 reconnaissance drones, 4 IRIST SLM anti-aircraft systems, and other air defense equipment.
Iranian culture and food.
Part 2.
Along with language, flag, religion, customs, traditions, and national arts, food and sofre are among the elements that define nations' identities. Food is a delicious part of culture of every nation and is a good measure to determine kindness, generosity, ethics, protection of environment and nature, and the type of its worldview. Iranian dishes have stories rooted in history. Many of today's dishes in the world were first made and cooked in this country. Iranian dishes have original and natural tastes. We use spices as much as necessary in food. Each culinary school has prominent aroma and flavor that is introduced with it. The fragrance of Iranian cuisine is made of saffron, cardamom, and rose water and a golden color. Iranian food has a mild taste. In cooking, we pay attention to the benefits and what is harmful in the ingredients. Everything must be in balance. Shah, pure animal oil, ambarbu, tarimi and hashimi rice, lamb of Mughan, afshar and sangsari, Azerbaijan yogurt, desful citrus, dates of bam and bushir, Khorasan wheat, and north and south fish each have a special and unique taste. This documentary is a tribute to thousands of years of Iranian cooking. This work is about Iranian food. It is about people we don't know but who are involved in our sustenance. This documentary is a tribute to the mothers of this land who taught their children the cooking traditions of Iran generation after generation so that this old and unique art remains eternal. This documentary is a tribute to our beloved country, Iran. Iran is a country full of wealth in so many ways, tens of generations before us, and we use the same Iranian dishes, and it is up to us to protect the sacred heritage. I'm Nusha Tabibi Gilani. I am interested in Iranian culture and food. Thank you. After the invasion of Mahmud Hotak and the destruction of the Safavid dynasty, a turbulent period was imposed on Iran. The conflicts and rise of Nader Shah and the overthrow of Shah Tahmasib II and the rule of Karim Khan Zand brought short periods of balance and peace that were not very stable. In these periods, naturally, decorative arts and the construction of buildings and emirates were not considered and did not have a chance to grow. Agha Muhammad Khan, the ruler of the Qajar dynasty, established a new era for Iran by unifying the country and establishing regulations, stability, and security. In this period, the construction of buildings, state emirates, and decorative arts started again. Qajari special aesthetics gradually appeared. There is a mixture of delicate and detailed Safavid art and European-style paintings. The use of new colors and patterns signaled the beginning of another era in Iranian fine arts. Iranians have the same skill in cooking various types of bread as they have a unique skill in cooking different types of ash. Bread and ash are predominant in Iranian cooking and play important roles in our cuisine. Cooking each of these important elements in Iranian sofre needs different skills. Many hidden treasures of the Iranian culture and history can be found in Khorasan. Now we are in Guzaldarre Sofla. We will visit a place where they cut noodles. We will know about the process of making noodles. Cutting noodles is a very common job in Sultania and Guzaldarre Sofla. It means that there are several workshops and people eat different types of noodles. Sultaniyeh was a center of the Ilkhanids government, and it may be the reason why so many people eat noodles in this area. Eating Chinese food was the Ilkhanids culture and can be the reason for the establishment of so many workshops here. These workshops are still active. Sultaniyeh was a city that did not last many years. It suddenly appeared in history by the Ilkhanid kings, and it was destroyed after Muhammad Khodabandi's death. He left many important works in this area, like knife making in Zanjan, cutting noodles, and Dashkasan Temple. Zanjan va mesle shayad hamin reshtebori va albatte ma'bad Dashkasan.
مغول‌ها همیشه غذاهای ابتدایی نمی‌خوردن. در واقع بعد از اینکه به چین حمله کردند و موفق شدند.
The Mongols did not eat simple foods. After the Mongols invaded China and succeeded in occupying it, they became familiar with the complex culture of the Chinese cuisines and they liked it. After the Mongols invaded Iran and succeeded in occupying it, they brought the same Chinese culture to Iran. It was from then on that we didn't use the word khalegari for cooking. Many believe that the beginning of eating ash and pilaf started from the time of the Mongols. Morteza Ravandi, the author of the book Social History of Iranians, believes that eating rice has been common in Iran since the 15th century. Here is Dashkasan Temple, and it is a very important place because it is the meeting point of Iranian Chinese or Iranian Mongolian culture. Arghun Khan decided to construct a temple when he still believed in shamanism. After his death, Ultaje Khatun, his daughter, continued building this temple, but when Oljao II became Shia Muslim, the construction of this temple remained half-finished forever. The important point is that maybe there was a Mithraic temple or a pre-Islamic facility here before the construction of the temple. We could see the signs of such infrastructure here. Why is it so important to us? As I said, it is a meeting point of Iranian-Mongolian culture. Ilkhanate architecture is more of Iranian architecture rather than Mongolian. There are dragon sculptures that are Eastern symbols. Iranian and Mongolian